Today, I have on Radio Gorgeous an author who specialises in women's social history. She's written a fascinating book entitled London's Lost Department Stores, A Vanished World of Dazzle and Dreams. This is her third book, and her name is Tessa Bowes. Welcome back, Tessa.
Hi, Josephine. Thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure. So the way we shop now is rapidly changing. We just receive a parcel nowadays with no human interaction. Shopping was once the most exciting and glamorous experience. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it was. We've got this awful expression nowadays, offline shopping, because the norm has become online shopping. Offline shopping is when we hit the bricks and mortar. And back then, Central London was an absolute parade of department stores. I mean, if you got out at the tube at, say, Tottenham Court Road, walked along Oxford Street, then down to Piccadilly, you would have walked past 12 department stores on your way, all of them enormous. And they were just absolute palaces of consumption. They were called the cathedrals of consumption, or cathedrals of desire. And the great emporia of our Victorian and Edwardian ancestors. They were rabbit warrens, because the early ones were kind of knocked together rather than built. So the classic story starts with a draper, comes from somewhere like Wales or the Midlands to make his fortune in London, opens up a draper's store, think William Whiteley, for example, and they expand sideways and they colonize eventually the whole block. Rather pleasingly, there's often one little business that refuses to be colonised, like a little bakery or a jeweller's, that they have to somehow build around. But eventually they take over the whole block. And they are rabbit warrens. And there are wonderful stories of, there's one Victorian story of Lady Florence Paget, who went shopping with her fiancé in the 19th century and gave him the slip in Marshall and Snelgrove. Met her lover on the other side of the store. Husband couldn't find her anywhere. And off she went to marry her lover, because they were so kind of higgledy-piggledy with staircases and, tiny rooms doing...
But were they glamorous? Yeah. Were they glamorous in Victorian time?
I think the great glamour came in the Edwardian era. That's when the rebuilds happened. When they got the whole block and they thought, right, we need a new facade. We need to start again, bottom up. And the big leader for the glamorization, particularly of Oxford Street, was Mr. Selfridge.
Who we know because of the TV program.
Who we know. Selfridge is still very much with us. Mm. That brash American came over in 1909, he opened Selfridge's, and no one had seen the likes before. So the things he did differently: massive plate glass windows. And up till this point, window display was this sort of mind-boggling kind of collage of materials. So they'd create, for example, a steam locomotive out of rolled up towels. That was window display.
Honestly, I think that sounds quite exciting.
I mean, it was crazy. You just did not know where to look. And they had lots of competitions and they'd win prizes for cramming the most things in a window.
Oh, so it was very busy. It wasn't elegant.
Busy, busy, busy. Selfridge had, one spotlit model wearing an extraordinary dress with an incredible painted backdrop. So he turned it into theatre, and all the other department stores rushed to catch up. Window design became a thing, a science. He also encouraged, it was very much women could wander around touching things, trying things on. And his slogan was, why not spend the day at Selfridge's? And he was encouraging single women, essentially saying, this is a safe place. There was a reading room. There was a restroom to recover if you felt overwhelmed by consumption.
I wish there still was. It'd be fantastic, when your feet open.
I know. Well, there was also, D.H. Evans, there was a reading room for husbands.
Now that is perfect. Yeah.
That's very civilised, isn't it? Yeah, so while your wife might be having her the girth of her ankles narrowed, slimmed, as one of the services offered by the fabulous beauty floor on D.H. Evans back in the 30s, your husband could wait in this reading room for husbands, or your lover maybe. And so, yeah, architecturally, they became more and more phenomenally glamorous. The materials they used, marble, they were kind of burnished copper and nickel, wonderful glass cupolas, these great glass domes. No department store was complete without a fab restaurant up at the top.
Well, you probably hear music as well, you know.
Yeah, there would be bands, there would be dances, there would be fashion shows, but not just in central London. Mm. I mean, amazingly, some of the most glamorous were in places like Sutton or Croydon, which, you know, were their own realms. You didn't have to go to the West End to get a
very
slice
clever,
of glamour.
Very clever out-of-town shopping, yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. I mean, one of my favourites that no one's really remembers today, it's Kennards of Croydon. And during the 30s, they hired the West End's highest paid window dresser. And he took over the store, and it was all about crazy mad theatre. So to demonstrate a new line of stockings, they got from the Folies Bergères, Paris's highest kicker, to come and do, I don't know, 100 kicks a minute to show people what she was made of wearing the stockings.
Oh, I already want to buy them.
I know. You know, aeroplanes that had done incredible solo flights were reassembled inside department stores to pull people in to look at them. There was Bentalls of Kingston. They got a Swedish stunt diver woman to leap off a really high board into a really small pool of water in their glass atrium. This is all in the 30s. So even if you just popped in to buy a Pyrex dish or, you know, a pair of evening shoes, all this was going on.
It's fantastic. So it literally was, it was theatre, circus, everything put together. It was beyond
and
your wildest dreams.
Didn't have to buy either.
Oh, that's very attractive. Yeah.
I think what it also was, from the other side of the counter, was it was a career, particularly for women. I think that the first career where women could really rise through the ranks, they could break through that glass ceiling eventually. And it was also a community, you know, right up to fairly recently. And I found these rather poignant Facebook groups online called things like I Remember Pratt's of Streatham, people who worked there, and they all say best days of my life. They had staff outings, you know, they were really looked after. It was, are you being served? Of course it was, but there was a kind of security and a joy in feeling that you belonged.
Yeah, family. Yeah. Mm. Fantastic. So this sounds the most thrilling project to do. How did you find out about them?
My curiosity was, it goes back to when my mother was a drama student in the 60s in Chelsea. She needed to earn some money, so she got a job in Harrods pet department.
Where two of the dogs in our family came from.
Really? Well, she got to take, you know, a basset hound home for the weekend, for example. It was fairly eccentric. And then talking to her friends, and she's now 80, they all worked in department stores. They all had these little bitty jobs, either maybe as a house model. You could reliably pick up respectable work. I mean, perhaps if you were in Big Bieber in the mid-70s, it wasn't quite so respectable. But it was where kind of nice girls could get a job. And their descriptions of these stores made me think, well, do we have anything like that left today, that culture at all? Where have they gone? And goodness me, another one's closed. And I started researching this just at the beginning of the pandemic. And like dominoes, they all started to fall. And Boswell's of Oxford, Jenner's in Edinburgh, Debenhams, you know, what a massive swathe that cut through the remaining department stores. House of Fraser on Oxford Street, which was once the fabulous D.H. Evans. So the project seemed to me more urgent as time ticked by, and I kept reading statistics such as we've lost 83% of our department stores in the last 5 years. 83%! So I thought, well, we're at this tipping point, and this is really a lost world. I need to talk to people who worked there.
Yes, quickly.
And to dig further back to understand how these fabulous stores came into being. You know, what was this moment of kind of frantic consumerism? How was it sustained? And why did it all go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. So you've already touched on life as a shop girl, but I mean, the expression shop girl was quite derogatory when it first started, and it wasn't seen as, you know, it was, sorry, you know, in Victorian times,
yes,
it was very much kind of lower middle class. And can you tell us about their conditions and how they change, how the conditions changed through the years?
It was a derogatory term. And they lived in, I mean, it really, it was like going into service. They lived in dormitories, highly segregated, obviously, often in the attic roofs. Endless stories I found of when department stores caught fire, as they often did. You know, these girls and the young men too, roasted, they died, and that was really bad PR for the stores. They lived in, they had staff canteens where the food wasn't great. They were fined for all sorts of things, for being late, for wearing the wrong, you know, type of buttons on their black dress, for apparently, you know, being rude to a customer, for being, you know, one penny out in the accounting. They were fined, and Whiteley's was particularly draconian, and all the fines went into William Whiteley's own pocket. He was really hated as an employer. So agitation for workers' rights kind of began mid to late 19th century. I mean, one of the campaigns, believe it or not, was chairs for shop girls. They couldn't sit down, and they were behind
these chairs for 12 hours.
12 hours or more, 15 hours. I mean, insane. Mm. Maybe 7 in the morning till midnight. They couldn't sit down. So an act was passed, the Chairs for Shop Girls Act. The stores could have a chair, but they didn't necessarily let their girls use them. Just having the chair tick the box. And the girls were paid, obviously, less than the men, of course. That bit by bit, conditions changed. But the big game changer was when the girls at the Army and Navy went on strike. They just suddenly refused. They said, enough, we want proper pay.
When was this?
This was in, sorry, I need to just look this up because I have 50 department stores in my head.
They I'm trying to know when the checks sort of got the strength together.
Yes.
To
1919.
Oh, interesting.
It's fairly late.
But
they went on strike.
War, interestingly, yes. Because that's
interestingly,
they suddenly had the freedom, and they'd suddenly, you know, they'd been able to work and have jobs, and this was the time of suffragettes. Well,
yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm. Sorry, I can hear my dog barking in the background.
No.
They were earning an average of 22 shillings a week, which was just a pittance.
What's that like now?
That is maybe about 20 to about £30 a week. You couldn't live on that.
So the
workers wanted a 35% pay rise, 44-hour week, payment for overtime and holidays, and wages during illness. I mean, everything we absolutely take for granted now, they had none of that. But the interesting thing was, there was overwhelming public support for it.
Fantastic.
When the public discovered that the founders of the Army and Navy, the military founders, were getting shares repaying at 350%.
Oh.
So all the demands were conceded.
Fantastic. And then that ricocheted throughout all the other.
Yeah, there was an absolute spate of strikes after that. John Lewis, although John Lewis would not give in, He just
incredible.
Said,
well, I thought it was meant to be owned by the people.
Yeah, yeah. No, the founder, he was a founder, had a kind of iron grip. Mm. He was famously curmudgeonly, and he just sacked his 400 strikers. And they were just snapped up by Pontings of Kensington.
Great.
The house for value, as it was known.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe delighted. A little class A, but they still yes. got a job.
Yeah, they got, you know, quality shop girls. So.
Yeah. So these are people's lives. It's quite a big thing, isn't it? You know,
these are people's lives. And I've had some very poignant correspondence with people since my book came out last month. Mm. People who used to work in these stores have got in touch with me, and I'll just read you what Howard wrote to me. Howard Bills, he's probably in his 80s. Mm. And he said, I'm an old retired shop assistant, spent my entire working life in retail, thoroughly enjoyed it. He said, in my humble opinion, retailing today is the merest shadow of its once glorious self. Looking through your book reminded me how privileged I've been to have seen and worked in such lovely spaces.
Wow.
And there is a lot of that. And I'm wondering what the future holds. And I'm very interested in Dover Street Market in SW1, which is an old bank full of really high-end, kind of quite quirky, fabulous designer gear. But they've made it the ultimate immersive sensory experience. It's all about nooks and crannies and sort of tactile decoration, art installation, the playoff between art and clothes or whatever accessories, which is exactly what department stores used to be.
It's also got a kind of turn of a century feeling, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And if we were going to...
I'm talking about last...
exactly.
Yes. Not the 2000s. Yeah.
Yeah, the Edwardian vibe. Mm. And if we're to attract the younger generation, or to sort of make them get, you know, to get them offline
and excited,
So this weekend, I took my two teens up to town, and I thought, right, we'll go to Brick Lane. That should tick the boxes. And to get there, we got off the train at Stratford International and realised that we had to walk through Westfield Shopping Centre to get to the Tube, which to me is my idea of hell. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to lose them here. They're just going to take one look and go, you know what, Mum, we're staying here. Not at all. Mm. They really took against it. It's so impersonal. It's so hermetically sealed. Mm-hmm. You know, these shops kind of endlessly replicated.
Yeah, and they're all the same everywhere you go. I mean, that's a terrible thing about globalisation.
The same old brand.
It's the same, yeah.
People kind of drifting around aimlessly. Mm-hmm. So we got out the other end, we got to Brick Lane, and we got lost in the end in the vintage market, which is in the basement of the old brewery, Truman Brewery.
Yeah.
Fantastic sensory experience. All these little concessions kind of, all of them looking different and alluring, and sofas to sit on, assistants who knew their stuff, who were quite fun. That, I think, is where the money is for that generation. Yeah. So
it's going back to when I was young, I worked in Kensington Market, and that was very, very like that. And
yes, that's right.
You know, sadly, everything in central London has become, you know, property developers, the scourge of my life. But yeah. Because they take the soul out.
A test case at the moment. The old Deco building, the M&S headquarters on Oxford Street.
Yeah.
The west end of Oxford Street. M&S want to demolish it. They say it doesn't serve our purposes. We're going to knock it down, build it again, make it much kind of bigger and shinier, because that's what shoppers want. Mm. And it's been taken to court because, well, the argument is to destroy it. Is so much more environmentally costly than repurposing it.
Yeah.
And Griff Rees-Jones is weighing in there and saying, just use the historic features with imagination. And let's rethink this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's make Oxford Street somewhere that people want to come to because it's offering something really different.
Yeah, yeah. No, I really agree. But But can you just tell me, if you could have gone to any of these stalls, Tessa, which one has caught your imagination?
Yes. Well, if I could be whisked back in time, it would be to the grand opening of D.H. Evans, which then became House of Fraser on Oxford mm-hmm. Street. Because okay. it had a fabulous deco rebuild in the 30s. 1937, it reopened. Mm-hmm. King George the Sixth had his coronation that same year. And it just sounds like the most divine sensory environment. It was London's most modern shop at the time. It was higher than anything there was. And the walls, for example, were pink travertine marble. The floors were glowing cork tiles. The sides of those amazing crisscrossing escalators, there was a huge escalator atrium. People went to London just to see the escalators at D.H. Evans, all boxed in the 80s. Were of kind of polished silver and polished copper and pewter, this kind of interplay of gorgeous metals. Whole floor given over to beauty. They made all their own products in-house. It just sounds, an environment for women, really, very opulent sensory environment.
What store was your store when you were growing up? It must be somewhere you met your mum for lunch, that sort of place.
Yeah, where did we go up to? Well, we very much went up at Christmas, and that's when most people's first memories of department stores are, you know, going to see Father Christmas.
Yes.
We went to Harrods, because she once worked there, and we queued. But we got a really good look at the windows on the outside. It was, I think it's where children of a certain generation first learned to really look. It's like being in a museum.
Yeah.
Your eyes were on stalks.
And I must say, I took my children, because I lived out of London when they were little, and I used to bring them and I used to take them to Harrods. It's what I'd done as a child, and they still have amazing memories of it. They absolutely loved it.
I think that it's very common to hear that mothers hand down to daughters often it goes mothers, daughters. It's where you have your special times together, where the memories are made, and where you end up taking your own daughter and then or your elderly mother.
We met our granny. I'm from Harrogate. And we used to go to this place called Cresta, which used to be Marshall and Snelgrove. So we'd meet Granny for lunch in their sort of cafe, which was quite posh, or trellis and kind of plants. And then we'd love it because we'd go down to, was Miss Selfridge in the basement, and we'd go to Miss Selfridge and get new clothes. So it was like the dream place for me when I was a teenager.
They worked for every generation. So you could just sort of say, right, meet you under the clock at, born in Hollingsworth or whatever, you know, at 3 o'clock, and you will all have done your stuff.
Yeah.
I've got a friend, a bloke of a certain age, and he's so sad that the Army and Navy closed.
In Victoria, I remember it.
Drive up there, you could park quite easily, just before Christmas, do all his Christmas shopping, get it all hand-wrapped, get it all loaded into his boot, and then drive back to Sussex, job done.
Yeah, marvellous. And that's what I like about department stores. I can walk in with a list of things to do. And that's why I often end up in John Lewis, because I have to get things like cotton reels and, you know, or things with curtain hooks, or, you know, that's what I love about John Lewis, but it still has, obviously it's a much smaller department now, but it's still got all, you know, that's what we think of John Lewis, it's practical. Yes.
Haberdashery.
Yeah.
But why would you not do that online? Because many would argue, but, you know, one
stops. You don't get the right colour, you don't get the right, you haven't touched it. The whole thing is about shopping is a touching sensory experience, isn't it?
Yes.
And getting what you want. I mean, I talk to 20-year-olds and they say, oh, well, I order a load of clothes and then I can't be bothered to send them back. And it's like, what? You know, the waste is disgusting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the satisfaction that can never somehow deliver after the unboxing, you think, oh.
Yeah, it never looks good. The fabric's not as good.
No. But the trip to the store is all part of the pleasure of owning the item, isn't it?
Yes, no, really, really good. And I love that going to the loo, having lunch, you know, all those things which make you feel like a day out.
Going to the loo, Mr. Selfridge.
Powder room. Yeah.
Oh, the powder room. He put ladies' loos in his department store. unbelievably, no one had done that before. So you couldn't spend all day in town. And with that, you know, one stroke was actually, you know, it was helping women's emancipation by allowing
women always need, there's always a queue. I was in John Lewis last week and there's always a queue. And I went to one place and there was such a long queue. I went to the next floor, there was still a queue. I mean, women literally.
Yes.
Especially of a certain age. Also, I really love Fenwick's in Bond Street. That's really my favourite store because it's so small. And every floor, and I like the sale, I can't afford it in real life, but I go there when it's a sale, and every floor is small, and it, but it has terribly good, tasteful products. And in their loos, you get a spray of perfume as well.
Goodness. Yeah, I think maybe the next book should be a guide to London's loos.
Yes! London. Oh my God, I love it!
Yeah, I mean, some department stores have very cleverly kept their loos as they were because, goodness, the fittings were so beautiful.
Glamorous, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, glamour. For me, it was the feeling of that carpet, the ping of, you know, going up in a lift maybe, the feeling, you know, the windows before you get in, the anticipation, and the feeling that you're safe is fabulous in a department store.
Yes, and toy departments, I mean, how great were they?
Yeah.
Once upon a time, with things being demonstrated.
Yeah, I always wanted that job, actually, being a demonstrator.
It's probably still available, but I mean, Hamleys is, you know. Yeah. Well,
I never enjoyed Hamleys. I found it too much. I've much preferred Hamleys. Hamleys was a bit in your face, you know, a bit stressful.
Yes. It still is, I believe.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. Who's this book for? I mean, obviously it's for us because we record it. Who would you buy for Christmas then?
Well, I think it could cut many ways. So we've got kind of, you know, Howard in his 80s who used to work in retail. Mm. And indeed much younger people who worked in retail who still have wonderful memories. I think anyone... 45 years plus who remembers department stores, everyone has their own particular personal attachment to a store, and it's to do with family often. So there's this deep nostalgia. But I think younger people could, you know, learn a thing or two about how it was done back then.
Yeah, and I can inspire them to go and open amazing places.
Yes, I mean, if we are to save the high street, what do we take from those former eras that had people getting on a train from, you know, way, way, way away to come to town in order to see whatever it was at whichever store?
So let me just finish off. Thank you so much for coming on. London's Lost Department Stores, A Vanished World of Dazzling Dreams is published by Safe Haven. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you, Josephine.